You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Wednesday, we continue All Marine Radio, and we talked a lot about winning the peace, phase four of operations, if you will, on this program, and how much the United States struggles with that, and has struggled with it since the, I don't know, where do you want to put the pushpin in on the map? Do you want to put it in Korea or Vietnam? And then just about every stop since then, we could discuss it. And joining me to talk about a guy who did okay in phase four, and that is General George C. Marshall, Secretary Marshall, times two. And Rob, how do you say your last name? Is it Havers or Havers?
Mac, it is Havers.
Well, first of all, Dr. Havers, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.
All right.
Good to be here, and good morning to all your listeners.
All right. Well, we, George Marshall is one of those guys who I realize that, you know what, I don't know enough about that guy. You know, who was he? I have a friend who went to VMI. He's now a general officer of the Marine Corps. He won the Marshall Award at VMI. I said, well, I'm not really sure what that means, but that's obviously good, yes. You know?
Indeed, yes.
We tease him about it, and do you think George Marshall is rolling over his grave when he looks down upon you? And he would laugh. But it was one of those as I have viewed the way the United States and in particular struggles with the aftermath in Afghanistan, with the aftermath in Iraq, with operations in Yemen, Somalia, and all the different Libya, all the different places, and the continued destabilization, you know, you're a fool if you don't look at post-World War II, the way that was handled, and who's the central figure in all that, in George Marshall. And then I have the epiphany is that you don't know anything about that guy. Other than he was, you know, he was the guy that you don't hear too much about because you're hearing about Eisenhower and Patton and you even hear about Omar Bradley, Douglas MacArthur before you hear about Marshall. And so I wanted to have somebody on who could tell us about General Marshall. And then are there lessons that can be learned that are as important as applicable today as there was in the post-World War II time frame? And so along those lines, I stumble along to Rob Havers. So Rob, first of all, we need to learn about you, and then we'll talk about George Marshall. So first of all, you, born and raised where?
Born and raised in the UK, as you can probably still just about tell from my accent.
You don't you don't sound like you're from around here. Now the UK, can you explain what is the difference between the UK, Great Britain, and England?
Well, that's a good question.
Thank you.
So the UK is the political entity, and it's the United Kingdom of Great Britain, which is England, Scotland, and Wales. United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So it's four countries together, united by, under the crown, as the UK. Great Britain is the, as I said, Scotland, England and Wales, the three countries on the large island,
okay.
And Northern Ireland is the northern half of the island of Ireland. And the whole of Ireland was part of the UK until Irish independence in 1922.
Yeah, until they finally sobered up, walked out of a bar and said, you know, maybe we ought to grab a rifle after all these years and boot these guys out of our country.
You know, Mac, it's a little more complicated than that, and there's an awful lot of Irishmen who would consider themselves, think of themselves as British first who live in the north.
Right.
And in fact, in a previous career, I taught military history at Sandhurst for the British Army Educates Officers. And in terms of a sort of largest proportion of the population of each of the constituent countries of the UK who serve in the British Army, at the time I was there, the Northern Irish were the most heavily represented. So,
really?
Very interesting. Very interesting. And also a lot of guys from Southern Ireland, from the Republic, served with the British Army.
How do they do that? Do they go to Northern Ireland and enlist, or how would you do that from a, you know, how do I serve in the Canadian Armed Forces if I'm an American?
Well, in the British Army is if you're a citizen of the Commonwealth, and if you're a citizen of Ireland, you have eligibility to serve with the British Armed Forces.
Okay, now hold on. You threw another word, the Commonwealth. What is the Commonwealth?
Getting all kinds of axes of advance here. Well, the British Commonwealth of Nations is the name given to countries that were formerly part of the British Empire, that as they achieved independence, an attempt was made to keep them, to maintain an association, a fraternal association. And so the British Commonwealth of Nations is comprised of those countries formerly British, either colonies or dominions, and they exist not informally, but as part of a group. Interestingly, every 4 years there are Commonwealth Games, so the Olympics on a much smaller scale, but with countries that were part of the old British Empire.
Okay, and that would be countries like Canada, Australia, India.
Yeah, New Zealand, India. Pakistan.
Okay. All right. We're all being educated. So where in the UK did you grow up? What city?
So I grew up mainly in. I was born in London. Grew up mainly in southwest England. The two most southwesterly counties: Cornwall, which is the most southwesterly county, and then latterly in Devon, which is the next most southwesterly county.
Okay.
Educated in the UK. Trained as a historian, military historian, really. Had a role at Sandhurst teaching military history, as I alluded to, and then
let me stop you and ask you this. So, yeah. did you ever serve in the military, or were you did you go down
no,
the road
I did not.
Of
I, I was
historian?
A,
and how did you yeah. mi- how did you migrate to military history? I don't think it's too hard growing up a post World War II. You know, like I did, you know, watching movies and seeing that and being, I was certainly enamored with it. How did you gravitate towards military history?
I always had an interest in history in general, and
right.
probably the big events of the 20th century are dominated by First World War, Second World War, had family members that served and lived through the Second World War, and as a young child, my grandmother was still alive, and my grandfather had served in the trenches in World War One, and she remembered, certainly for the early part of my life before she passed away, quite vividly the experiences of the First World War, obviously in her case as a civilian back home in London. But then she lived through a second conflict, global conflagration, World War Two. So World War Two, growing up in sort of England in the 70s and 80s, seemed to be an ever-present. There's that. The generation, probably, to appropriate the term, the greatest generation, the men and women that fought and won that conflict, was still comparatively young in the late 70s and 80s, and it was only in the 80s that they really began to sort of step down and retire from public life. So my teachers at school, some of the older ones, had served in World War II, and so I think that probably stimulated my interest in, you know, like most boys, interested in guns and tanks and war movies, that sort of thing.
Got it. Now talk to us about Sandhurst. That the teaching there is no small deal. How does that happen?
Well, my PhD thesis was a topic concerned with the fall of Singapore, fall of British Malaya in 1941-1942, and the experiences of British and Australian prisoners of the Japanese. And I had, obviously, as I said, an interest in military history. Mm-hmm. Applied for a job teaching war studies at Sandhurst. Interviewed, was fortunate enough to get it, and so I taught there for 3 years or so. Wonderful time, thoroughly enjoyed it. Great place, does a great job turning out young men and women into junior officers. So great experience.
You ultimately wind up at another foundation, the Churchill Foundation, yes?
I do. I applied for and got a Fulbright visiting professorship to come to the U.S. for 1 year. And it was tenable at a place in Missouri, a small college called Westminster College. Great school, liberal arts institution in the classic American mold. And also had another distinguishing characteristic, which is that in 1946, Winston Churchill had come to Fulton, Missouri, to Westminster, and delivered one of the most significant addresses of his long career, what became known as the Iron Curtain speech, the Iron Curtain address, right, when he warned of the threat of Soviet Union in the post-war world. So to honor that speech, Westminster had created a memorial to Churchill in the 1960s. It brought a church from London, disassembled it stone by stone, reassembled it on campus, and created a Churchill Museum and a Churchill Institute. And I was all set to head back to Sandhurst after my one-year Fulbright position, and the then president of the college asked me if I was interested in staying on, teaching history in a slightly different venue, running the Churchill Museum, and I sort of jumped at the chance. Churchill had been a hero of mine, and that's what kept me in the U.S., and then sort of migrated to the Marshall Foundation after a few years at Westminster.
So you said in that capacity you crossed paths with the Marshall Foundation?
Yeah, I'd run the Churchill Museum there, what became the National Churchill Museum, for probably 8 or 9 years or so. We had had some small connection with the Marshall Foundation here in Lexington, so I knew of the foundation, obviously knew of General Marshall. They were looking for a new president about 3 years ago, and I thought I could do with a new challenge, so applied for this position, and again was fortunate enough to be selected, and have been running as president the Marshall Foundation for 3 years or so. So moving to beautiful Lexington, Virginia.
Tell us about the Marshall Foundation. When was it established? Who established it, and what's its mission?
Well, the Marshall Foundation, we sit on the post here at VMI, the Virginia Military Institute, although we're an independent, not-for-profit entity. The Marshall Foundation really came about in the 1950s. Marshall's still alive, of course. He lives until 1959. But President Truman was keen to establish something that commemorated what Marshall had done and perpetuated his legacy, and VMI, of course. Marshall is one of its most celebrated graduates, very involved in thinking about what that might look like. And so the early years of the Marshall Foundation, it's a little cloudy when it really began, probably 1952, collecting Marshall's papers and beginning to write four-volume series of authorized biographies of Marshall by a historian called Forrest Pogue. And finally, the Marshall Foundation finds a permanent home on the post at VMI in 1964. And so the foundation has been here since then, 1964. So we celebrated 50 years in 2014, a couple of weeks after I arrived here. And we have all of Marshall's papers in a wonderful research archive and library. We have a museum. And we sponsor programs about Marshall, publications about Marshall, and really endeavor to ensure that, A, people remember him, and that there is an opportunity to learn from his long life and benefit from his successes and understand his mistakes. When the process was set up to begin the Marshall Foundation, and they were raising funds, and they were garnering letters of support from the great and the good who had served with Marshall, Winston Churchill himself sent a letter to one of my predecessors and talked about how history must not be allowed to forget General Marshall. And Churchill, I know a little of Churchill, having run the Churchill Museum at Fulton, Churchill was a tremendous self-publicist, a great man, but he knew how... he famously said, and I used this quotation many times, he said, "I know that history will be kind to me, for I intend to write that history." Of course, Churchill writes a six-volume history of World War II, and he advances his position in those volumes. And Marshall, of course, the antithesis of that, refuses absolutely to write his memoirs. Interestingly, we have in the museum here a gift given to Marshall by the Overseas Press Corps in Washington, D.C., given to him in 1949, and it's a gold-plated typewriter. And they gave it to General Marshall in the belief that they would encourage him to write his memoirs. And the whole gold-plated piece is sort of a not-too-subtle suggestion that, General Marshall, should you write your memoirs, the advance on that book would be tremendous.
Right.
But Marshall, in a very Marshall-esque fashion, takes the typewriter, thanks them very politely, uses it quietly to compose correspondence on, but never writes those memoirs.
Wow.
So that's a very interesting part of Marshall's character, and one of the reasons why, and this is our mission, too few people know who he is today, and if too few people know who he is, then too few people have the opportunity to benefit from an understanding of what he did and how he did it, which is really, that's the crux of our mission.
In the interest of me writing my own history, it speaks well that I made this phone call and I reached out to you, yes?
Yes, I would say so, yes.
I don't want to be too much like Churchill, but I don't mind borrowing a page. Before we talk about Marshall, I have two questions for you as a former Londoner. Give me 2 minutes on Brexit. What will be the impact on the UK and the EU?
Well, just a few minutes on that.
Yeah, two minutes. Give me the bottom line.
You know, I don't think anybody really knows what the absolute impact will be. There are obviously in the run up to the Brexit vote and in the campaign, there were outlandish tales from both sides of the Remain and the Leave camps that the world would end if one vote rather than the other came in. I don't know. I've been out of the UK 14 years or so now, so I watched this remotely and through obviously friends and family are still in the UK, and they were pretty divided as well. There were many who thought that it's not very British to have to yield, as they saw it, to an unelected European Parliament, and that the British have always forged their path in the wider world, and that they have always had a very close relationship with continental Europe, but it's always been a somewhat ambiguous relationship. I've got other friends and family members who thought that it was economic suicide to leave, and that the opportunities of the EU far outweighed the downsides. So what's going to happen? Who knows? I mean, the reverberations are still impacting British politics today. There was a general election in the UK just back in June, and once again, all the predictions and all the polls proved to be erroneous, and the government, far from enhancing its majority in pursuit of more authority for a stronger Brexit, had it reduced. So I just don't know.
Okay. I think that's a pretty good and candid assessment. I'll ask you a question about the EU. As a casual observer as an observer of the news, the actions of the United States in Iraq in particular have destabilized that part of the world. We have not been any, I think somewhere George Marshall is looking down and just cringing at what we've done there. That destabilization has created an immigration issue in Europe. And I'm curious, just your thoughts on how does Europe deal with it? It looks like some of its issues relative to immigration from the Middle East into, you know, because I don't, when I think of Germany, I think of Lederhosen. Okay, I don't think of the Muslim. I don't think of the mosque in Germany and the German culture embracing that. And we've seen the issues that France has had. Do you have an opinion, or what are your thoughts on what's going on in Europe today and the different forces that they wrestle with?
Well, that again, Mac, is a terribly complex situation and difficult to get a...
You're a PhD, for God's sakes. Quit the...
Well, if a PhD gives you any sort of authority, it's to probably understand that everything is far more complex than it seems.
And there you
go. Simple answers are hard to come by, but... Undoubtedly, Western Europe, or Europe as a whole, is grappling with an end to many of the certainties that have governed the post-war world. So the post-war world that General Marshall, as Chief of Staff of the Army and then as Secretary of State, helped establish, all those certainties, all those parameters, all those pillars, it's a very different world. And it seems as though it's all of a sudden. Immigration is a hot topic, and it certainly informed the Brexit debate in the UK.
Right.
It's undoubtedly, Angela Merkel is up, I think, for elections in Germany in the autumn, in the fall, and it's going to be a hot topic there as well. If I had a solution to this, I'd be sitting in Washington DC, hopefully making it happen rather than speculating here. But it is.
I'll accept that. I mean, it's certainly an unsettled issue, and you listen to the way people are talking about it, and then you see the violence sometimes that's associated with it, and the forces behind that violence. It's there's substantive issues in those nations that they're trying to grapple with. And so this concept of the European Union, this free flow of immigration in the Union, to me is certainly an interesting concept. And then when you layer the immigration policies of different nations on top of that, it certainly is an interesting concept. So, one more question for you. This is an easy one, though. Churchill. A gigantic figure in 20th century history. Churchill's chief contributions are what?
I would say that Churchill's contributions are many. If you had to say what is it that he does that no one that outweighs everything else, and that probably few, if anyone, could have achieved. It is when he comes to power on May 10th, 1940, as Prime Minister. It's the day that the Germans invade France. And within 6-7 weeks, continental Europe is under German domination. And Winston Churchill almost single-handedly, and through his power of his rhetoric and his willpower, encourages, convinces the British people something that is on paper impossible. He convinces them to fight on. So I think Churchill's achievement, and I mean he was played a huge role in British politics before the First World War, in the First World War, in the interwar period, and the post-war period. But Churchill, if you had to say what does he do that is the defining moment of his career, that's how we see him probably appropriately. So it's his ability to mobilize the British people, convince them of what needed to be done, I think, rather than probably what many people thought they could have done. Because an accommodation with Hitler was certainly on the table, and there were sections of British society who thought that would have been infinitely preferable to fighting on. So I would probably say that. And Churchill, much like Marshall, is a fascinating character. Churchill's career pre-World War II had an awful lot of ups, but it has an awful lot of downs. And Churchill, as an inspiration, is somebody that is incredibly resilient. He always gets back up. And he famously, one of his quotations, and it's somewhat apocryphal, he and we had it, I think we had it on a T-shirt in the gift shop at the Churchill Museum. It said, "If you're going through hell, keep going." So he was adamant about the need to push on and to be resilient and to never give in. And they sound almost trite when you think about those sort of almost like platitudes, but certainly resilience is central to any career success. And General Marshall, of course, demonstrated resilience on a similar scale throughout his long career.
Yeah, you know, they do sound, you know, some of that stuff does sound trite, and except when you lay it on the times in which he lived, and you're saying, you know, that can be kind of a boilerplate statement, except when you layer it on to when he lived, the crises that he faced. And then attempting to navigate a nation through those times becomes much more substantial when they're layered upon that. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Dr. Rob Havers, and he is the president and CEO of the George C. Marshall Foundation. We're going to talk about General Marshall coming up next. But again, the reason I want to have Rob on, in addition to doing a liberal arts discussion with him, is to talk about the crisis that the world faces today. General John Allen was on the program a while ago talking about the need for a Marshall-esque plan between the United States and our allies, and maybe even some of our opponents. Russia comes to mind. In terms of how do we point the Middle East in a better direction, and what are the things that need to happen, or else, as he said, my sons will fight there, his grandson will fight there, and we will be there for a long, long time. So in that vein, Dr. Rob Havers joins us this morning. We'll take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for All Marine Radio, the All Warrior Radio Network. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts at 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug, scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, BattleMug.com.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
On the west coast of the United States. Mike McNamara with you, doing All Marine Radio on a Wednesday, and privileged to be joined this morning by Dr. Rob Havers from, he's the president and CEO of the George C. Marshall Foundation. So we're going to continue to our discussion and learn about George Catlett Marshall. So, Rob, first of all, is there a figure in history in the 20th century that has a greater impact on the world than George Marshall?
You know, Mac, I would probably say probably not. Certainly not in a positive sense.
Maybe Hitler. And Hitler, I'd say, down the list, I mean, certainly had a short-term impact on the century. Maybe Stalin, in a very negative way, had that kind of an impact. But I don't know, in a positive way, as you said, anybody else that has a longer reach than Marshall does in terms of what he did for the world in the second half of the 20th century.
No, absolutely, and the thing about General Marshall is that he does the hard things. He as chief of staff of the army in World War II, and he becomes chief of staff on 1st of September 1939, the day that the Germans invade Poland and begin the process that eventually engulfs the whole world and what we now call World War II. So Marshall is chief of staff of the army, and he gets there as chief of staff after a very long career. He graduates from VMI in 1901, has a little bit of time before he gets his commission, spends a long time in a very small army, goes through World War One, the interwar years, finally reaches the top of the ladder, chief of staff of the army, and his role then, with all that accrued experience, is focused on mobilizing this country, preparing it to fight a war that he probably knew was going to come, and the preparation that they did in a very short amount of time, Marshall had been a long-term advocate for preparedness well before the U.S. joins the war and well before the war breaks out. But his role as chief of staff and as a indispensable military aide to FDR, Marshall is, and I'll quote Churchill again, Churchill called him the real architect of victory in World War II. So Marshall does all that, and that's pretty impressive, for a general, but then he takes off that uniform, becomes Secretary of State, and really wins the peace. So one of the taglines of one of the ways we think about Marshall at the Marsh Foundation is that he is the man who won the war and then goes on ostensibly and essentially to win the peace. And I can't think of anybody other than in U.S. history, probably George Washington, who did as much in war or did as much in peace and to make the fruits of victory on the battlefield stick so that nobody's coming back in another 10 years or another 20 years or another 30 years and doing the same thing again. And that's exactly what you alluded to just now, Mike, when you were quoting General Allen. Marshall took on board the results of that not terribly permanent peace after World War One, and realized that you have to do more than was done then, because otherwise you will be fighting the same conflict again. And I, in the 20th century, I can't think of anybody that's done as much in those two. We often think of war and peace as polar opposites, but in some sense they're two sides of the same coin. And in the whole spectrum of history, U.S. history especially, probably George Washington.
All right, let's talk about Marshall himself. Born and raised where?
Born and raised in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. But from a family that had its origins in Virginia.
Okay. All right. Talk about his upbringing. You know, and again, George Marshall born in 1880. Okay, so yeah. Think about that. So he is as a young boy. Let's see, as a 10-year-old boy, the veterans of the Civil War that were in their 20s when they fought are in their 60s. So he grows up with veterans of the Civil War around him in his neighborhood, and that's the world that he grows up in. Talk to us about how does the military get on his horizon?
George C. Marshall's elder brother had attended VMI. And George had, a good sense of rivalry with his elder brother, Stuart, and wanted to follow in his footsteps and probably outdo him. Marshall's father had served in the military in the Civil War, so the Civil War is an ever-present. And when George arrives at VMI, the superintendent is General Scott Shipp, who had led the cadets of VMI at the Battle of Newmarket in the Civil War. So that Civil War piece is an ever-present.
Yeah.
And Marshall, I think, believes that he can make his mark in the military, and he certainly does that at BMI. And he is he's a little different from the cadets at the time. He's obviously a northerner from Pennsylvania, and this marks him out somewhat, but he overcomes all kinds of challenges and eventually finishes as first captain of the Institute in his senior year. So he's an impressive figure at VMI, even as a young man.
All right. And he has a typical assignments. Where does his career start to hit a different trajectory? Is it in World War One when he crosses paths with Pershing? Where does his career begin to change as somebody who's going to be, or at least on the track to being one of the principals in the United States Army, which is still a pretty small organization at the time?
No, it absolutely is, and the army he joins in 1902 or so is. Incredibly small, 25,000 men, I think. There's a congressional act to enlarge it with concerns over the Philippines but Marshall's sort of growing up parallels, if you like, the growth and the confidence of the United States on the world stage. And so the story of the United States and the story of Marshall are obviously, but terribly intertwined in that as Marshall ends his career as Chief of Staff of the Army, the United States as a nation stands at the sort of apotheosis of its global power. So that's a sort of fascinating parallel story. But Marshall serves in colonial entanglements in the sort of pre-World War I period. The promotion and progress is slow in a small army. He does very well in World War I. He becomes a sort of protege of General Pershing. And Marshall enters the war as a major and then ends it as a temporary colonel and then is dropped back to lieutenant colonel. And again, in the interwar years post that, it's a very slow progress. Marshall's ambitions in World War I are for a combat command, but his adeptness as a staff officer really meant that he was didn't get that opportunity. But he makes his name as at the Battle of Saint Mihiel, and the logistical demonstrates a logistical brilliance in moving U.S. troops under the cover of darkness to positions to attack the Germans in a pretty substantial battle at the end of the First World War, and earns his reputation as a logistician and as a staff officer and the nickname of the Wizard. And then again, as the army is drawn down post the expansion for World War One, Marshall again finds himself only moving forward quite slowly. Begins to make a name for himself, however, in a number of different areas. He is goes to Fort Benning as a deputy commander of the infantry school there, and begins to think about changing how the army is small unit tactics and rewriting the army tactical handbook, and begins to keep an eye on officers coming through that he thinks can be useful officers in the future. And Marshall has a few key appointments that I think speak to his, he has a breadth of experience that few officers could match. He spends time on the West Coast at Fort Vancouver, where he's involved with the Civilian Conservation Corps, part of the New Deal.
Right.
And he gets to experience organizing civilians and instilling in them some sense of army discipline and shared purpose, shared endeavor. And I think that is something that stands him in good stead when he expands the army or is beginning to think about how you expand a very small peacetime army. And I think the United States is something like the 14th or the 15th largest army in 1939, behind the likes of Uruguay and all kinds of countries you never think of having substantial military.
Yay.
And the U.S. Army at the end of 45 is in the region of, you know, 8 million men, and I think 11 million in the armed forces in total. So Marshall has a sense of what motivates civilians. He also spends time with the Illinois National Guard, so he also sees men who have an interest in the military, but are civilians Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. So he's got a breadth of experience, I think, that few senior officers have, and he has an understanding about the, I think, I say this as an expat Brit, so it sounds a little odd, but I think he has an understanding of the American psyche and the suspicion of large standing armies, but what it takes to motivate civilians to fight for their country, but also understands that wars need to be won as quickly and as efficiently as possible, because endless wars are anathema to the American sense of democracy. So I think he has this very complex and subtle understanding of these necessities. Marshall at BMI is not an outstanding scholar by any means. But unlike many general officers, Marshall is a constant advocate for the need to learn from history. And we have in the Marshall Papers collection here, we have a copy of a lecture he gave to a joint session of the American Military Institute, what becomes the Society for Military History, and the American Historical Association, in December of 1939, and he laments the quality of history taught in U.S. schools, colleges, and encourages the teaching of a history that really looks at why wars are lost, as well as why wars are won, in the belief that it's necessary to have an informed citizenship, citizenry, rather, if you're ever going to win a war on a large scale, if you need a large army. So he's a marshal. I'm not sure. You would probably say that he comes to these pieces through experience, and that he has just a very good sense as to what has worked, what can work, and what has failed.
Rob, where does the wizard tag come from? Is that simply his staff work in? Because what he sounds like is a guy who has a gift for seeing all the pieces and seeing the larger picture, as opposed to just being an infantryman or a commander of infantry forces. Marshall is gifted by his ability to, and I hate to use the word, but I'll use it, synthesize these things and to see the whole, which not everybody does. Is that what gets him this tag, the wizard? Because that's certainly not a, with all, I don't have Harry Potter coming to my mind right now, but.
No. Right? Well, and obviously that tag predates substantially Harry Potter, and it's probably an older sense of the wizard. But it came to be associated with him due to his ability as chief of staff to Pershing and the switching of forces in the Meuse Argonne to Saint-Mihiel under the noses of the Germans, and enabling U.S. forces to fight on one front, switch places with the French under the German noses, under the cover of darkness, trains, all the rest of it, sort of a move of logistical brilliance, the kind of thing that you would imagine a wizard waving his wand and making happen, and conjuring it up. That doesn't do justice to the complexities of what he undertook there.
And that's exactly what you just said. Doesn't do justice to the complexities of the issues. The things that we talked about that Marshall encounters is the United States doesn't have a large standing military, and it not only does it, it's never had what he will create in terms of just the victory plan. How many divisions? How many ships? Where do they get built? Who builds them? How do you do this? And so, not only the build out of the United States military, the build out of the industrial complex that will build all this stuff. So, to me, when you begin to look at the problems that he encountered, they're staggering when you think of it. And there's no American history that gives you a blueprint to do this. There's not. He creates it, and so he's, to me, fascinating in terms of where he came from, where the nation was at that time, with no prior history of these things, and then him creating it. This, and as you said, he was never a knock it out of the park, academic. You know, it's not like he went to Yale or Harvard and then, joined the military and then these things kind of bubble back up. He's a fascinating, fascinating guy.
No, he is, absolutely. And the fact, Mac, that you and I are sitting here and we're going over his achievements, and the big question is, well, how and the why did he make this happen? And Marshall, he could have done us all a favor and written his memoir and sort of answered a lot of these questions, but he's obviously he does not do that. I mean, he doesn't do it in part because he saw when General Pershing published his memoirs and saw the bitterness and the sort of flack that he got and the hurt feelings and all the rest of it. So he's adamant that Marshall's never going to replicate that. But a lot of these sort of use mysteries in a loose term here, but we can look at what he did, and one of the things we've done quite successfully at the foundation in recent years, we have a series called the Marshall Legacy Series, and we try and look at Marshall's life beginning to end and all the different areas in which he's involved in, and we have lectures and movies and discussions about key parts of history of the 20th century, the First World War, Second World War, and try and draw Marshall out from the shadows by looking at his impact on others and sort of trying to focus a little more in detail about what it is that Marshall sees that so few others do see. Because he does have this sense that he can look around the corner or look over the horizon that too few others have.
He smokes it. On, I mean, when you look at you know, the endeavors that he's involved in, and again, this is, in my opinion, what makes him unique in world history. His ability to fashion the peace so that all the fighting that you did ultimately achieves, and you know, when I talk about these things with people and I try to create a visual explanation for them, I say, you know, when you're done with the fighting, for we Americans, you might be at the 40 or the 50 yard line on your side of the field. The key to it is winning the peace and fashioning that which you went to war for, or it's all for naught. And they look at you, right? They look at you like, what? What do you mean? Like, no, you know, when you have the victory parade after the war, that's, you didn't win. You're not in the end zone. What do you mean? You won the war? No. You won the conflict. There's a greater fight that's going on here, that is to fashion something that's economically viable, that is politically, I want to say solid, and able to deal with its neighbors in a way that it hadn't been able to, you know, heretofore. And so Marshall seems to be one of the few people in certainly in American history and in world history that's able to see, and his on such a huge stage, this through to its fruition. We are dying. If I pull a string from Vietnam, and I could pull it from Korea, but I won't, from Vietnam, right, through our involvement in Lebanon, through our involvement in Somalia, into Afghanistan, into Iraq, and back into both places, the United States flounders in phase four, which is winning the peace, which is why I wanted to have you on. And you look at Marshall, the build out of the army, the build out of our industrial capacity, and then okay, now, and I'm managing that, and at the same time, what do we do beyond this? What do we do in the peace, and how does that work? How do we treat them so that we actually win this conflict? And he just seems to be one of the most unique men in world history, and he certainly comes from an ordinary background. And then, you know, his constantly being in the background of much more flamboyant figures, guys like even Eisenhower, much more flamboyant. And Eisenhower wasn't that flamboyant, but certainly MacArthur, certainly guys like Patton. When you think of the Army, that's who you think about. And sponsoring the whole thing is George Marshall. He is the benefactor. He's the sponsor. He creates it all, and they get to go, you know, be the kind of the glamour pusses of the war. And he's just such a unique character in world history. It puzzles me why we don't study him more. I've got to take another break here in a minute, but let me give you a chance. And then what I want to talk about is, I want to talk about him and get your thoughts about him in the post-World War II world, how he sustained what they conceived and how he did that. But your thoughts on that far and wide-ranging little diatribe I just went on. He's truly an incredible figure in world history.
Yeah, absolutely. Are we going to a break, Mike, or do you want me to comment now?
You go ahead and comment now, and then we'll come back.
Yeah,
we'll talk about how he did it.
I think part of it is the man himself. He commands respect in every situation. His self-control is legendary. He betrays his emotions only rarely. He conveys the aura of incredible presence, conveys his command presence is substantial. So he has a calming influence on all those around him, but he always encourages subordinates to... Marshall is the role model for loyal dissent. He corrects Pershing in World War I famously. He corrects FDR famously in World War II, and he encourages his subordinates to stand up for what they believe in, but be prepared to argue it if they are in disagreement with him. So the man himself is key to much of what he achieves. I firmly believe that, in that he conveys this authority, and he is a fair man and also a wholly devoid of political ambition or artifice. I think that's very key to how he commands this respect as a civilian post his military career. But he does, you know, this is what makes him such a fascinating character, that he manages to achieve all this in such an understated fashion. But again, that's key in thing, I think, in part to how he does achieve it.
Yeah, and that's probably part of his character that is not well known. Among the many great things that he did was, you know, his interaction with FDR, his interaction with Pershing, and you know, when we as Americans look at a war that in Iraq that we should have never fought, there were guys in our nation's government in my opinion, should have stood up and been more Marshall-esque. And said, "Nah, I cannot, with good conscience, be a part of this." And not only voice their dissent, but gone beyond voicing it and saying that, "Look, I don't think this is a good course of action for the nation. Certainly doesn't need to be done." But no, he's an incredible man, and I'm excited to doing this. If you can't tell, an email for you, Rob, before we go to the break. Mac, I am loving this discussion about General Marshall. We certainly need one. It looks like General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, is poised to maybe be somewhat in the same kind of position that General Marshall was. For those of us that are novices to Marshall's life, is there a good biography that Rob would point us towards? Rob?
Yeah, you know, I would certainly encourage everyone to visit the Marshall Foundation website, which is marshallfoundation.org. Lots of interesting stuff there, but probably the best one-volume and quite slim biography of Marshall, very well written, full of detail, is Dr. Mark Stoller's George C. Marshall, Soldier Statesman of the American Century. Published in 1989, still the definitive work, definitive short work, just a fantastically well written and great overview introduction to General Marshall. So I thoroughly recommend that. And as I said, we've got interviews and articles and you name it on Marshall on the Marshall Foundation website.
Got it. And that is marshallfoundation.org.
That's right.
Got it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how he, in fact, did it. The world faced with, the United States in particular, but the world is faced with many similar situations, not on the same scale, of course, but similar situations, and we seem to struggle with this, the winning the peace phase. So a privilege to have Rob on, and we'll continue our discussion next as we continue a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you, the Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light, put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life? The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
On a Wednesday, fascinating stuff. We're privileged to be joined this morning by the president of the George C. Marshall Foundation, and that is Dr. Rob Havers. And we've been talking about George Marshall. What a unique man he was. What what unique times he lived in, and how the incredible challenges that he faced. He smoked it. I don't know that there's a. Maybe I'll write a book about Marshall, and I'll give it a much more hipper name, a title. He smoked it, George C. Marshall. He smoked it because he did. When you look at the challenges, they're unbelievable. Robert, let's talk about it. First of all, let's talk about the build out of the army of the military, and the expansion of the industrial base. What is Marshall, how does he do it?
Well, Marshall, has been a long and deep thinker, I think probably from even pre-World War I about the need, but one of Marshall's constant refrains was, the need for something he called, UMT or Universal Military Training, which is sort of not conscription, but something that at least prepares the civilian population to be ready if necessary. If the need comes for a bigger army, for a bigger conflict than that which the, as we've spoken about, the small standing army cannot deal with, so that you can expand exponentially without too much trouble. But he he doesn't have much success at making any of that happen. And then, comes chief staff of the army in 1939, and then in 1940 he's faced with that absolute absolute necessity. So he goes about it in the sort of Marshall-esque fashion. He persuades industry, successful captains of industry, to head up key parts of the drive to rearm and to use good civilian methods, I think is a one way to think about it, of staffing up at a very, very short space of time. Marshall is willing to, out of pure necessity and with an eye on what is needed, he's willing to sort of cross social boundaries, if you like, encourage women to come into the military, into the army, and fulfill roles, sort of break the color bar somewhat in recruiting African American troops, and he's certainly focused on the need to grow the military and by whatever means necessary. So he has some degree of latitude as chief of staff of the army, and he's the backing of FDR to sort of do whatever is necessary, and he recruits some very very adept individuals to help with that. I think one of the things that we talked a little bit about Marshall seeing over the hill or around the corner, he does have a sense as to what he's a good strategic thinker in many ways, and that he focuses all his efforts towards the overarching aim, and does so very effectively. You see that chief staff of the army, and is also a secretary of state in the post-war period, when he employs similar methods, the methods that worked in wartime, he employs them in peacetime in with a Marshall Plan.
Talk to me about the expansion of the army. So is it essentially the same approach expanding the army as it is in expanding the industrial base? But that has to be conceived, you know, in 1940-41 because of the time it takes to simply create all of that. You don't even have the bases that get built to do the training with these incredible numbers that we talk about. So it's almost like, yeah, I'm looking over the horizon at a world that doesn't even exist and people don't have any concept of now, which is fascinating stuff. Same kind of stuff that it gets bright people together that have some expertise in these areas, and they take the United States military, all branches, and put it on steroids, and then put that version on steroids as well. It's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's very impressive. It's very impressive how he does it, and he does seem to have this ability to draw people together and get them working together in a fashion that obviates, maybe all barriers that would have interrupted other people. It is very impressive, and of course the U.S. industrial base grows substantially. One of the clever things about really the Marshall Plan, I know we're sort of jumping ahead a little bit, is that the end of World War II, you have a vast industrial base in the U.S. that's been turning out Sherman tanks and B-17s and Liberty ships. And the switch to peacetime production is probably, there's going to be a peace dividend, but this industry, the scale of the industrial output is not going to be it's not going to be needed on a wartime footing. But the Marshall Plan essentially ensures that U.S. industry keeps functioning on that similar scale because it's now producing not just for a domestic market, but also the very much needed implements for a destroyed Western European economy, so tractors and all those sort of things. So,
Rob, would you say most people are ignorant of that kind of under the radar or under the waterline part of the Marshall Plan? Because when most people hear Marshall Plan, they think of Europe, right? The rebuilding of Europe. They don't think of the transition of the U.S. economy from wartime to peacetime economy, and all of these people that will be thrown out of work And then also the industrial capacity that we've created that will now go idle, and if it's not used, it will, you know, it will fall apart and be rendered moot at that point. Do most people understand that?
No, I don't think they do, Mac. And I think, I mean, and what I just said is a gross oversimplification. But fundamentally, I think that too many people think of the Marshall Plan as essentially U.S. money given out as a sort of a welfare handout, which of course it wasn't. It was a very well thought and very well considered stimulus to the U.S. economy. And it's also a very well-considered and well-thought-out way to ensure that one of the main stipulations of the Marshall Plan is that the European economies, they don't come bilaterally to the State Department or to the Marshall Plan administrators and say, we want 5 million tractors for France, and the Belgians say, we want X amount of tractors. The Europeans are compelled to get together and come up with a plan that reflects all of their needs and then come as a collective. And so that is a terribly clever thing, because it means that a lot of the enmities of the pre-war period and the war period are somewhat lost, and eventually, what becomes West Germany gets rolled into that very substantially. And it provides that building block of cooperation that really has helped, was really led to the EU that we were talking about earlier. But it ensures that people who are not well versed in working together are obliged to work together if they want to benefit from what the Marshall Plan has to offer. And the Marshall Plan is not just a load of money to spend on different things. It's actually practical implements to rebuild your economy purchased from the United States that helps U.S. manufacturers. So it's a very sophisticated financial system, as well as a sort of very sophisticated movement of goods and services. And the whole thing is I would not claim to be an expert on the intricacies of it, but broad brush, that's essentially what it is. It's something that shores up the U.S. economy. It's something that shores up the economies of Europe, not just to shore them up, but so that they will be good allies in the future with a vested interest in maintaining peace, because peace has led to prosperity. So it's a really far-reaching endeavor that has no parallels, as far as I can, no historical parallels.
Let me read you an email. Mac, I'm listening here. I've stopped what I'm doing here at work to listen to the discussion, and I'm thinking about the woeful state of our conflicts today. Marshall, genius on top of genius on top of genius on top of genius, is pretty astounding listening to it. I, like many, when I hear the Marshall Plan, think of money to Europe. To think of the transition of our industrial base to a peacetime industrial base and the Marshall Plan being a part of that is truly staggering to think of. We need a Marshall now. So my question for your guest is this. Why have these lessons been lost on our national leaders low all these years? Rob, you want to venture a guess on that?
No. Yeah, no, I'm happy to. Hey,
go ahead.
Come on for the easy questions. Well, you know,
you know, you're going to have to take a nap after this interview.
This is the serious stuff. You know, I have to say, I do not believe that. I would say, as a historian, I would say people need to pay more attention to history and to study history. It doesn't mean that you're going to get an ABC of how to do it, because the lesson of the Marshall Plan is that it's not that applicable to other situations. Marshall is famously asked when he wins the Nobel Peace Prize, can we do the Marshall Plan elsewhere? And Marshall said, very adroitly, he said that in Europe you had a good section of different classes. You had an upper class, a middle class, and a working class. And in other countries where this has been proposed, there was in some countries you only have the very poor and the very rich, and without that middle tier, the notion of a Marshall Plan for countries without that is just nonsense. So
why? Because the elites will take the money and nothing will trickle down to the
Yes, I think that's what he was alluding to, and that there is nobody to make it happen. And so Marshall essentially is rebuilding first world economies in Western Europe,
right.
And he's doing it in first world economies that have some good history of democratic governance. Germany doesn't have a long history of democratic governance, and that was sort of hand in hand with what happens with rebuilding creating a new constitution for West Germany as well. So you often hear we need a Marshall Plan for this and a Marshall Plan for that. I often take that as just shorthand for we need some kind of a plan, but it's also grounded in the lack of understanding as to what the Marshall Plan really was and the subtleties of it, and we sort of alluded to some of these pieces. But the original question, why is it that our leaders don't seem to be able to act in that fashion? I think it's not for lack of trying, but some certainly have an understanding that you need a longer-term view. But I also think we're living in a world where the sort of attention span of people is shrinking. Politicians seem they've always been attuned to demands from the public, but there is a lack of, I think there is some sort of, and this is terribly inarticulate, and I'm struggling to sort of articulate it even in its
inarticulacy. Yeah, I know, because with that British accent, we expect articulate, just so you know.
Well, there is, I actually think that the guys that fight and win World War II and fight and win the peace post-World War II have a long grounding dating back to World War I. They drew the lessons that all that sacrifice on the Western Front and on fronts around the world amounted to nothing much because they were fighting again 20 years later. So they're determined not to repeat those errors. They understand that, as I said earlier, that war and peace are two sides of the same coin, that military success will get you so far, but unless there is something to follow up with that and remove the need for people to try and achieve their goals through violence and military action and obligate you to come back and fight the same war again, you've got to take that away. That's what Marshall understood with the Marshall Plan. And so our contemporary leaders, I just don't know. I mean, there are many out there who do think deeply. We talked about General Allen. He spoke for the Marshall Foundation about a year ago in D.C., said very similar things. General Mattis understands that there's a role for military action, but there has to be something more. Otherwise, you haven't really removed the cause of the need for that.
You might as well not go if all you're going to go. I mean, I would say to Afghanistan to kill Osama bin Laden and the people that engineered and were a part of that, absolutely. But then just leave. Again, it's just so frustrating. In fact, I when you were talking about the price paid, they were tremendously scarred by the price paid for World War II to turn around and go back and fight again in, 20-odd years later. And I remember, I can't remember the name of the book. It's written by a Catholic German officer. He fights down. He's a cavalry officer. He fights down the same road in France that he fought in World War II as he fought in World War I. And he talks about that.
Right.
The waste of it all, the waste of life. And here he is fighting, again, down the same road, this time in a tank, 20 years prior on a horse as they went into France. And it just seems like, and I agree with you, do we not read this stuff? Are we so? But again, the guys that are not reading it, the guys that are not knowing it, are guys like Don Rumsfeld. That we somehow think that we can go do these things and then just leave the area and it's all going to be good. And it's like you put your hands to your face and you're like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Do you honestly believe that? And so, you know, I think the world definitely needs another marshal. Are there things, how did he, so he has to sell that to the United States. He has to sell that to Europe. And then he also, you know, does time as Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State. Are there things that were unique to what he did that allowed it's not only its creation, but its sustainment that led to the fruition of a very stable Western Europe, which is only now being kind of roiled by tremors, you know, for the first time in its post-World War II existence that he essentially engineered. Are there things that were really unique about Marshall and the different places that he went that allowed him to sustain this? Or was the plan just conceived so well that it would be sustained no matter who was in those positions?
No, I think Marshall has a very key role. I mean, he delegates a lot of the complex planning to the individuals in the State Department and others. But Marshall is, and this sound, again sounds trite, but he's a sort of salesman for it. He convinces, he goes before the House, he convinces politicians of both sides of the aisle that this is a necessary endeavor. He speaks on tours in Europe and inspires Europeans to come together and do exactly what he said in terms of building bridges, working together to make requests for aid. But I think, and this again is a dreadful oversimplification, and it's far more complex. But I think Marshall the man is key in that he commands such respect. He is seen to be in his every action, and known to be by reputation to be an individual who puts service above self. Nobody for one moment thinks he is doing any of this for his own personal gratification or personal advancement. And I think that, and couple that with the stature of his reputation as Chief of Staff of the Army and delivering what he delivered in the war, I think all of these things come together. So you have a man who commands almost absolute respect and admiration. And there are, I mean, he faces criticism at different times for different things, but more or less, he is seen as a man without vice. He's seen as a man who's wholly apolitical. He is seen as a man who's doing this with no notion as to what he can get out of it. You know, he's got that gold typewriter sitting on the desk, and he's not writing his memoirs. He's not doing things with an eye to how he's going to sell the story in the future. He's about duty, absolutely. And I think, as I said, combine that with his adeptness and his ability, and you've got a sort of a man who can transcend politics and the sort of many of the challenges that so many people falter with or seem distracted by. It's an incredible story. It's one that, as I said at the very beginning, too few people really understand or appreciate. And you can learn so much from history. You're never going to find out how to do it. There's no open history book, and it's, well, you know what? In Iraq, in 50 years' time, you need to do X, Y, and Z. You can only ever be inspired to look more deeply or to think about the implications and the ramifications. But there's so much to learn from Marshall. One of the interesting things that about, and this is a Churchill comment, is that Churchill, the junior officer in the British Army, fights on what was the old British Northwest Frontier of British India, now the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And Churchill writes in one of his earliest sort of works, he talks about fighting the Afghans on the border there and the sort of Badlands, as we know it today, between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And he said, one of the things I took away is that the Afghans will happily fight amongst themselves forever. As soon as we entered their territory, they forgot their local differences and ganged together and fought us. And when we withdrew, they went back to fighting each other. And he said, there must be a lesson there, surely. And I remember reading that and thought, 100 years later, nobody really read that work of Churchill, and that's not a blueprint for how you deal with the modern Afghanistan, but it's certainly an added note of complexion, or at least a pause, And I think Marshall had that sense too. He'd seen what had happened after World War One. You know, all those casualties, and then the Treaty of Versailles, which, you know, you might say it's not a bad treaty, but it's never enforced. But the will to enforce it is the problem. But there's no reason for Germany to get back into line after World War One. Everybody has inflation, depression, that the economic piece of things is so substantial. And Marshall, I think, and it's difficult to know what he actually thought because he does his, you know, doesn't help us by putting it on paper. But I'm sure he had a very good sense that unless you solve those economic difficulties, you absolutely will be back again. And he did not. He'd been there twice already.
Talk to me about when, and I'm sure this issue comes up on a pretty regular basis. This whole idea of a modern day quote unquote Marshall Plan, and I think when people refer to it a Marshall Plan, not so much that the looking to clone the Marshall Plan, but looking to include all the diverse elements that Marshall included in the Marshall Plan into a plan. Whether it be a plan for Syria, whether it be a plan for Afghanistan, when you see people discussing that, are there certain things you say? Look, if you're going to go down that road, these are certain things that you need to know about what he did, how he did it, before you go down that road.
Yeah, I think what we would say at the Marshall Foundation is understand the situation. Understand that there are a number of things in Marshall's favor somewhat. First of all, the massive U.S. economy that can be somewhat repurposed. There is a willingness on the part of destroyed nations in Western Europe to rebuild their economies back up to where they were. There is also the notion that that there's a threat of the Soviet Union. So that is out there, and how do you deal with the threat of the Soviet Union? Well, you can leave those 8 million men in the field in Germany. Well, that's never going to happen, so you need to have something else, and they certainly leave a lot of men behind in Germany for 50 plus years. There are there's still a sizable military presence there. So if you're going to say, well, what is the equivalent of a Marshall Plan for somewhere like Syria, I think probably think about what are the unique circumstances of that country. When, if ever, has it been well-governed, well-led, stable? How can you replicate those things? Probably a good understanding of who you're dealing with and what you're dealing with, and probably too resist the notion of imposing on others your own preconceptions about what success looks like or what works here will work over there. The notion, and this is another trite comment, but the idea of cookie cutter solutions is never a good one.
And I guess if you go down that road, considering the complexities of a region, and also looking at as you alluded to, what it looks like when it was successful. What happens if when you come back after doing a little bit of research and say, you know, what we're endeavoring to create has never existed in the history of this nation? So if the Marshall Plan for Europe was, 60 years, the Marshall Plan for Syria would be 160 years. Are we prepared to do that? And I think it certainly, I mean, if you had a broader, and this is, I guess, my beef with some of the conflicts we picked, and the way we've gone about it. If you don't have to do too much reading to take a look at that and say, if we go to the, what is it called, the Colin Powell Pottery Barn, if you break it, you own it. If we go in there and we break it and we decide we own it, we are talking about a 100-year commitment for the United States and our allies, should we decide that we want to stabilize this part of the world? And is that something that we want to do? Is that something the American people will support? Is that something our coalition partners will support? And if it's not, then I think it has huge implications for the way you use force. But we don't seem to be able to learn that lesson, and we become embroiled in these situations that last decades. And it just it puzzles me why the greatness of General Marshall is not studied more as we go down these roads.
Yeah, I think you're right, Mac. It's I think Marshall at the end of World War II had Marshall steps down, retires in I think it's November of 45, and he's back as special envoy to China in December of 45, and he does that for a year. And in the next, you know, in March of 46, you have Churchill coming to Westminster College in Missouri and talking about Iron Curtain. And when Churchill spoke then, everyone who had thought, thank goodness the war's over, we've defeated the Nazis, the Russians, Soviet Union are our great allies, are confronted with this unpalatable truth that actually, hang on a minute, the Soviet Union could be a threat on the same scale and in the same fashion as Nazi Germany once was, so we need to redouble our efforts. So Marshall, when he comes to the office of Secretary of State, he's aware of that threat, but he also knows that there is a war weariness and that the American people certainly are not going to support a standing army of the scale that's going to be required to deal with the Soviet Union in that fashion. So there has to be another solution, and an economically vibrant Western Europe that is less susceptible to sort of insidious communist infiltration and revolution of the kind that was being threatened in and was happening in certainly in Italy and in parts of and in France a little bit. Economic security could do equally well, if not better, than military security. And given that military support on the scale that would be needed, military support alone was never on the table, there must be another way. And if you factor in the fact that the U.S. economy is willing and able to provide that, the U.S. government is willing and able to provide credits that will benefit the economy, it all comes together very effectively. But the ability to see that in the fashion that I really do think Marshall saw, replicating that ability, I just don't know how you do that. And I think Marshall drew on all those experiences from a whole lifetime of the 20th century, and they culminate then. And I think many of those leaders, Churchill included, are doing similarly so. And so we've got a generation of leaders who haven't almost been through that roller coaster of success and failure and perspective and longevity of experience, I think. And that there is no sort of – seems to be a lack of patience today, willingness to engage with things at the depth that is necessary. I don't know where that's come from or why. Maybe it's in part driven by technology. Who knows, but I think that's part of the issue.
All right, I've got an email, and then one final question, and I will let you go. My guest this morning, very graciously, is the president of the George C. Marshall Foundation. His name is Rob Havers. He's not from around here. You might know that. That's not a New Jersey accent you're listening to. The email, did the fact that Americans were affected by World War II, by the draft, by sacrifices at home, make Americans more receptive to a deep thinker and planner like Marshall? We're no longer affected by these wars in remote places beyond the thanks for your service mentality. The nation was at war in World War II. The nation's largely unimpacted. A small percent of us are impacted. Our families and friends are impacted. But the nation as a whole is not. Life goes on. We go to the lake. We go on vacation, you know, we go to the mall, and we watch it on TV, but that's the extent of it impacting us. Maybe if somebody in our community is killed, it darkens our doorstep. Did that have an impact on the way Marshall was received and his ability to do the things that he did?
You know, I think that's actually a very good point. I think probably for the first time in U.S. history, and I'm not a U.S. historian, but I think that the war drew the nation together on a national scale for the first time, probably other than the Revolutionary War. Oh, I guess the Civil War.
Yeah,
say.
The Civil War, maybe.
But that's a division rather than a unification.
Right.
So the country's divided in the Civil War, although everyone is more or less involved, or the impact is substantial. But in the Second World War, it is shared endeavor. And I do think that's got something to do with it. And then, so the wars post-World War II, thankfully, have been on a smaller scale, but they've also been fought by that professional standing army to a large extent. Vietnam's the outlier there, but so it's involved fewer and fewer Americans, and it has impacted fewer and fewer American lives. So I do think that shared endeavor is lost, undoubtedly. It still doesn't quite explain the sort of men like Marshall drawing it together in the fashion they did, but I'm still thinking about that, and as to the how and the why of that, and why it managed to endure so long.
All right, final question. We've been doing this for an hour and a half. What haven't I asked you about Marshall that is significant that you want people to know?
Well, I think we've actually done a pretty good job of covering a lot of it. I think we've covered this a little bit, but I think the fundamental thing about Marshall is that there's a lot to be said for Marshall being the catalyst for so much. He worked within. He redefined the parameters of organizations, and he worked within the constraints of organizations. But Marshall, the man, the way he conducted himself, the modesty, the discipline, the authority he conveyed, he's the indispensable man in many ways. And he was referred to by somebody called him that when looking at his service in World War II. And post-war, and he really is. He's the sort of linchpin of so much, and he's involved in so many things to a greater or lesser degree. So thinking about Marshall in that fashion, and then on the back of that, trying to understand the origins of that indispensability, I think are fascinating exercises for anyone. A lot of that comes from his education experience at VMI. And he's the product of so many experiences. You cannot easily put your finger on what it is about Marshall and try to replicate it, but it's something within that. And I think an understanding of that is key to an understanding of Marshall.
You know, one of the things that's interesting, and I got my degree in economics, is Marshall seems to understand the macro level at a very young age. I would argue that his brilliance as a staff guy is emblematic of that in World War I. As an infantry guy, understanding logistics, understanding time space, understanding movements, understanding our lift capabilities, understanding refueling. That is all not normally what, you know, infantry guys do. But Marshall seems to be able to replicate this macro understanding of, yeah, it'd be great to attack them there, but how can we do it? Logistically, it's a bridge too far. Well, let me take a look at it. And he seems to be able to take over and over in his life. And for him, the challenges are humongous. As I said, the creation of what has become the modern American military, the creation of the industrial base that supported that, the mobilization, as you said, the social innovations needed, because at the macro level, when we look at the population and we look at number of people we're going to need to fight and to serve overseas, it's not going to leave us enough workers. So where do we get more? Well, we get more from women, and we are going to have to enlist Black Americans and minority Americans to feed this beast. It's simply a matter of all these different things that he does, and then to include, you know, the Marshall Plant, right? That's American money to Europe, and we rebuilt them. Well, it's much more complex than that. And it's just fascinating how he has this sense of the macro in his head at a fairly young age as a staff guy, and then just continues to do good things, being able to think like this on a grander and a grander scale, you know, ultimately becoming one of the people who impacted in a very, very positive way our civilization, Western civilization and the world in the 20th century. Just a fascinating, fascinating guy, Rob.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a good way to think of him. It's an uncanny ability, and it is seemingly present in so much of what he does, if not everything.
Right. So, first of all, I hope you don't mind if we do this again.
My pleasure. It's there's a lot more to all of this, of course,
right.
And you can garner a lot of it from our website. But yeah, it's been great fun.
I hope now that you're prepared that this is like the intellectual deep end of the pool. We just didn't want to talk about a Sam Brown belt and his uniform. although we're happy to do that. I honestly believe the world needs a George Marshall today, and it looks like to me, Secretary Mattis is in a position because he has such great esteem. And his opinions are respected on Capitol Hill, and Rex Tillerson and he seem to have a good enough relationship that he can propose something that would be Marshall-esque, that would promote. And what is the quote that I put up of Marshall that I mentioned to you the other day?
The one when he talks about this is not directed at anyone.
Exactly.
I'm forgetting it too much, but it's not directed against any one enemy or whatever, but against poverty and yeah. It's on our website. You can have a look at that. Yeah, but that's right. It's a real bipartisan. What is the big goal? What is the big picture? What is the big takeaway? And it's not bogged down in any sort of, you know,
partisan nonsense. Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos. Its purpose should be the revival of a working economy in the world so as to permit the emergence of political and social conditions in which free institutions can exist.
Right.
You read that and you're like, wow, who is this guy? Marshall? Who? What is that guy? Anyway, Rob, thank you very much. Tell everybody the website. They can find more information about truly one of the great Americans in world history, George C. Marshall.
Yeah, but marshallfoundation.org. Come and visit us in Lexington, Virginia, on the post at VMI, and learn some more about this great American.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. You and I will cross paths in the future.
Indeed. Pleasure,
Mac.
Thank you.
Wow. I mean, honestly, they talk about a guy who we all probably should learn more about. Marshall's incredible. Absolutely incredible. And I will tell you this. I did not know that much about the role of the Marshall Plan in transitioning the American economy. I like most, you know, the military piece of it, the economic piece for Europe. You know, the stability, wow. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Phil Smith's going to join us. Day 3 at Gettysburg coming up next on a Wednesday edition, Hump Day, of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All I can say about militarybyowner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.